Everything is energy. And you come to Earth to learn how to manipulate that. To be a master manifester. So once you learn how to manipulate energy, you can have anything you want. Nothing is impossible. There are no limitations except the limitations you put upon yourself. Put upon yourself.
Listening to Neo Archives with That's the Way Life Goes, the Breakage Remix. That's about it for me for today. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. Feel free to check out my website at djfirefly.com.
With the modern Republican Party, allegations are often confessions. And the allegation that the failed former President Donald Trump has been making for months, if not years, that there is a weaponized justice system targeted at he, Trump, by Joe Biden, the current president, is not only completely without evidence, new reporting suggests that it's actually a confession of what Donald Trump plans to do to Joe Biden if he were to get elected and replace Biden in 2024. Axios reports, Trump and Republicans plot a 2025 criminal probe of the Bidens, Bidens plural. Republicans' impeachment probe of President Biden is unraveling because of a lack of evidence, but their work could become the basis for federal investigations and even prosecutions of the Biden family if Trump wins re-election, Axios has learned. A source close to the Trump campaign says everything you have seen from the Biden DOJ, you can expect to see from the Trump DOJ. One Trump ally argued there is precedent for a second Trump administration to investigate and prosecute the Bidens, the current federal charges against Donald Trump. Where do you even start with something like this? Number one, the authoritarian framework of Project 2025 is not only at a general federal level, it is also part of this unflinching desire to get Biden for what Trump claims is Biden sicking the DOJ and I guess the Attorney General of New York and I guess the state of Georgia, right? I mean, you'd have to believe a lot of crazy things, but Trump is alleging Biden is running these investigations and indictments of him. There's no evidence of that. But what does appear to be the case, and Trump has alluded to it, and now Axios is reporting it directly, is that Trump's plan is to weaponize the Trump DOJ against Joe Biden. Now, understand that, again, Biden's been in elected office for decades. They have nothing on him. It has been the sole focus for some Republican members of the House to find the dirt on Biden. And they haven't even found impropriety by Joe Biden, never mind anything approaching criminality. The witch hunt that Trump claimed was against him and was meritless, had merit. The witch hunt against Biden really does appear to be merely a witch hunt, and it has completely fallen through. And it's because the facts and the evidence aren't on the side of those going after Joe Biden. But it's not going to stop them from trying it. Once again, Catherine Stewart told us, Ellie Honig told us, all of these folks have told us, you have to believe these people when they tell you what they're going to do. And they are going to try. It is not going to stop them. And you know what? There's two sides to the James Comer realization that they're not impeaching Biden. Just as a reminder, James Comer has been one of the lead Republicans in the House who has been going on TV and pushing forward this Biden crimes narrative. They're just, all of the blockbuster evidence is just barely out of reach. They're about to get it. And he has now, Comer, has started sending out fundraising emails where he says, listen, the impeachment, it's not going to happen. Part of why it's not going to happen is Democrats control the Senate. They would never vote to convict. But the criminal referrals are why I need you to donate to me. And so they're being very clear. If you zoom out, Trump has alluded to it. Comer has said it. And Axios now has been able to report it. They want to remain in control of the House of Representatives in 2025 going forward. And they want to take control of the Senate in 2025 going forward, with the idea that they are going to be able to completely and totally function as an arm to target Biden and his family. This includes criminal referrals, which hopefully a Trump DOJ will carry forward. Now, as far as bogus investigations go, they arguably made a mistake, and it was a timing mistake. And again, it's all projection. Trump has argued that these indictments came at the time to be most advantageous for Democrats and for Joe Biden. I have argued that that doesn't really make sense. It would have arguably been better if Biden was directing Trump's indictments and they wanted to time it to be as useful to Biden's reelection as possible, they would be doing it later. They would be doing it now. They would be dropping the bombshells over the summer when more voters are paying attention. But again, the idea of timing of this stuff, what Republicans should have done to do more damage to the Biden campaign was launch all of this Biden crime stuff later as well. Republicans seem to have mistakenly started it too early. It's completely petered out like a wet, it's just like a wet noodle. It's collapsed. There's nothing there. Voters are realizing it. So when it comes to timing, Republicans do seem to have made a mistake. So it's a great thing that Axios got the scoop and has published this. At the same time, if you've been paying attention, it's obvious they tried it with the Hillary Clinton email lies and acid washing and bleaching and Swiffering and all of it. The emails, they're going to try it again. What we can hope for is they lose the House and they lose the White House and they lose everything and they have no opportunity and they're in shambles going into 2028. That's what has to happen if we want to make sure that they don't get the opportunity. But they're telling us what they're going to do. We should believe it. Donald Trump suggests that Jewish Americans who vote for Democrats, including for Joe Biden, are mentally ill. They're sick in the head. They need to be examined. We didn't get to this yesterday, but I want to get to it today because the continued attacks, but also assertions that to be a real fill in the blank, real Jews don't vote Democrat. Actually, most Jews do vote for Democrats. Jews are one of the most left wing voting blocks in the United States. Here's Trump outside of his plane in Atlanta on Wednesday. I don't know if he was getting on the plane or getting off the plane. Here is Trump saying, you need your head examined if you're Jewish and voting for a Democrat.
Again, they brought down the rate so fast because they want to get elected. And it's going to work out just
fine. Have you called Netanyahu? Have you spoken to Prime Minister Netanyahu? Obviously, the White House is issuing a stark warning. Do you think that the U.S. is not doing enough to show support for Israel, or are you going to go?
Biden has totally lost control of the Israel situation. He has abandoned Israel. He's totally abandoned Israel. And frankly, you know, he's a low IQ individual. He has no idea where he is and who he's supporting. He doesn't know if he's supporting the Palestinians, but he knows one thing. He is not supporting Israel. He has abandoned Israel. And any Jewish person that votes for a Democrat or votes for Biden should have their head examined.
Have your head examined if you are Jewish and voting for Democrats. So what Trump is saying is most Jewish Americans are mentally ill. Jews are one of, if not the, it goes back and forth with Black Americans, the most left-leaning, democratically supporting voting blocs in the United States. And Trump is saying most of them should have their heads examined for mental illness because of the way that they are voting. Now, it's also not lost on me the irony that you have a contingent of the left that says that Joe Biden is a genocidal pro-Israeli maniac. And on the other side, half of the electorate believes that Joe Biden is some kind of anti-Israeli, anti-Semitic extremist who doesn't care about Jews here, there, or anywhere. Conflicting narratives, certainly, about Joe Biden and Trump insisting you got to have your head examined if you're Jewish and voting for Joe Biden. Now, one other really funny thing. Moments after this, Harris Faulkner pretends that she's never heard Trump say any of this stuff. I'm going to play something for you where Harris Faulkner's guest mentions these things Trump keeps saying about Jews. And she goes, what are you even talking about? It happened moments earlier.
He said Biden has totally lost Israel on that issue and abandoned Israel. And then he went on to say, if you are Jewish in this country and you vote for him, you need your head examined. That was the full context of that. So, Marie, the way you made it sound was he just willy-nilly said it. What he's saying is that, look, this is a problem. There are anti-Israel protests right up until the line in front of Biden's home in Delaware. I mean, the Secret Service holding that perimeter around the president. They're showing up everywhere. The president's handling of the war against Hamas, Israel against Hamas, is costing him dearly.
Because, Harris, that's exactly the point. Because he's standing by Israel.
No, no, no. I said his handling. I didn't say his policy. There's a difference. It's not a support for Israel. He vacillates. He says he supports Israel and then gives them tons of ammunition. No. And so Arab Americans are saying
there
you're
are all
wrong,
these
Mr.
protesters.
President.
The reason there are protesters at every Biden event is because he has continually stood by Israel. He has repeatedly given them advanced weapons, more and more military aid to fight and to prosecute this war against Hamas. He has absolutely stood by Israel. And that's why you see these protesters. He has repeatedly questioned the loyalty of Jewish Americans. He has said anti-Semitic and offensive things about how Jewish Americans vote.
When?
Donald Trump has said anti-Semitic.
That is a lie.
5 minutes ago. He just did it 5 minutes ago.
To each of
literally.
You. Anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, all of it. All of it is what we are covering here, and we have to get our facts right. I didn't hear what you're talking about, Maria, but what I did hear him do is call Biden out for not having clear policy or security.
Harris Faulkner read the comments at the start of this segment. 90 seconds earlier, Harris Faulkner read the comments. Jews who vote for Democrats should have their heads examined. And then the guest mentions it, and Harris Faulkner goes, I don't even know what you're talking about. I haven't heard him say. You read the comments, Harris. Of course, it goes to the fact that Harris Faulkner would argue, saying that when Jews vote for Democrats, they're mentally ill. It's not anti-Semitic. It's not anti-Jewish. It's not problematic. But it is what it is. It's Trump, again, grouping voters in this particular way and then attacking them and saying the only way. Listen, excuse me. If black folks are voting for Biden, they don't know what's going on. If Jewish folks are voting for Biden, they don't know what's voting. They don't know what's going on. And anything short of undying loyalty to Trump signals either some kind of personal failing, mental illness, or who the hell knows what. This is not the venue. And I think that the guests are learning this. This is not the venue in which you're going to have serious conversations when you refer to something Trump said that was read 90 seconds earlier. And the host says, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't remember. And I didn't see any of that. More of this is going to continue. What the voting groups need to remember as a Jewish American who is planning to vote for Joe Biden rather than Donald Trump, there's nothing mentally ill about recognizing the lies that are being told about Biden and the reality of what Biden offers and looking at it soberly and saying, oh, Biden's obviously the better option. Nothing really mentally ill about that. Let's hear from some of the folks in the audience on the day where we normally do it, on the Friday show. We take calls on the Friday show via Discord at davidpakman.com/Discord. The quality of the calls varies dramatically from week to week through no fault of my own. I want to mention it's just coincidence. Let's start today with Brian from Virginia. Brian from Virginia, welcome to the David Pakman Show. What's on your mind today? What can I do for you? What have you been thinking about?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hey, David. Thanks for calling me. I had kind of a topical political question and then just kind of a different question, if I may. But my first question is just one thing that really honestly scares me is just the potential for, you know, obviously a Trump victory in November would in its own different ways be very scary. But in the event of a Biden victory, just the potential of violence, you know, as we saw in 2021, January 6th, having now learned from, you know, whatever their mistakes were, well, their mistakes
as they see them. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. What do you think can be done by like individuals as well as just kind of on a societal platform to mitigate or negate that?
Well, listen, there's two different things. I share your concern that there could be violence from Trumpists if Biden wins, although I don't want to be hyperbolic. I also think that as long as law enforcement is prepared, it's going to be OK. That's my expectation. I think as far as law enforcement goes, as long as they are prepared, the amount of hijinks that the Trump supporters will cause if Biden wins, I think will be controlled in advance. As a society, we need to just make it clear that there's no place for that sort of violence. You go and you vote. And if your side wins, great. Now you've got 4 years to govern. And if your side loses, you lost. Elections have consequences, and you don't vote, lose, and then go and become violent. And as a society, we need to really show that it would be shameful behavior to go out and commit acts of violence. And to the extent that people are very much influenced by peer pressure and groupthink, the more that it can be made clear by people on both sides of the aisle, I should mention, that there is no place for violence of that kind and that you are going to be ridiculed, socially ostracized. And if you commit a crime, you also might end up being prosecuted and rotting in jail for a while. I think that that is an important part of it. And then, yes, law enforcement has to be prepared as well. But also, Brian, let's not count our chickens before they hatch, if you know what I mean. And let's first deal with November 5th. If November 5th goes the way we hope it goes, then we'll figure out, OK, what sort of security and plans need to be in place for December and January for both the counting of the electoral votes and the inauguration. And I think law enforcement can be more than well enough prepared.
So it's kind of how, like, at the last inauguration, they kind of stepped things up as a result of January 6th.
Yes, they did.
So, and then just kind of a, I guess, kind of off the wall question. I know you've said that you're I think you've said ethnically and culinarily Jewish, but
yes,
not love religiously.
Right.
So I've been raised Christian my whole life, so I've celebrated Christmas, but my family's also in a lesser degree celebrated Hanukkah. Do you think that's weird or inappropriate for someone who's not like ethnically or religiously Jewish to kind of partake in that tradition?
I've been asked this before, and I even have friends who aren't Jewish whose kids hear about Hanukkah in daycare or something, and then they want to light the candles. I don't take any offense to people who aren't Jewish lighting Hanukkah candles or getting each other gifts. It's just, you know, there's so much going on. Who am I to get offended or upset if some non-Jews want to celebrate Hanukkah? You know, it really doesn't make any difference to me. The questions of cultural appropriation or whatever, I just don't care. You know, have at it. Light the candles if you want.
Fair enough. All right. That was why. Thank you so much for talking to me, David. Hope everything's going well for you.
All right. Brian from Virginia, great to hear from you. Let's go next to, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, is it Kojido from Mississippi? How do you pronounce your name, sir or ma'am?
It is Kogito.
Kogito. Okay, well, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, David.
Pleasure.
So, as an individual from Mississippi, come from a ruby-red conservative state, been here my whole life.
Yes.
I noticed there's a bit of a, say, an epistemological crisis among the Republican Party. It's an inability to accurately come to what the truth is. I've had a lot of conversations with friends and family in regards to January 6th, the fraudulent slate of electors. I've shown them the Eastman memo. I've showed them the fraudulent slate of electors on the National Archives website. I've showed them Kenneth Chesbro, Trump's lawyer, pleading guilty to filing these false documents. Jenna Ellis pleading guilty to filing these false documents. I've showed them Mike Pence, attesting to the fact that Trump asked him to overturn the results of the election. I've shown them Trump's tweet himself when he said, if Mike Pence comes through for us, we will win the presidency on January 6th. It's no doubt that he illegally attempted to overturn the results of the election. Yet for some reason, there seems to be a broad percentage of the population that can never accept this happened. And in the condition that it did happen, would support it regardless because it's not democracy they value.
Yes.
What are we to do in this scenario? How do you converse with these people? I hate to say it's to a point where it's impossible to change minds, but it sort of appears that way.
Yeah, there's two answers to this. There's what do you do on a personal level if you just want to converse with an individual to change their mind? And as I've laid out before, I know some in the audience will say, David, you've said this 1,000 times. You ask questions. How did they come to their beliefs? What beliefs, what facts would change their minds if they were to be presented? Socratic method of questioning, empathetic listening, all of those things. That's at the individual level. Separately, there's the question of what can we do at a population level to deprogram some of these folks such that it will make an electoral difference. I think it's a lost cause from a practical perspective because we only have 50 to 60% voter turnout. We are way better off, and people like Rachel Bitticoffer and other forecasters and political analysts, they all essentially agree with me that as an electoral strategy, sitting around trying to convert people like the ones you're talking about is an inferior strategy to just trying to identify folks who already sort of agree with us but don't plan to vote and explaining to them why it's so critical and important that they do choose to vote. So there's the individual question, more about personal choice and personal interactions. There's the electoral strategy part of it. Unfortunately, I think on electoral strategy, as far as 2024 is concerned, we've just got to go around these people and win despite their presence rather than trying to convince them otherwise, because it's going to be very difficult.
All right. And final question. As someone who wants to make a change or difference in the election, would you recommend, say, I know there's a lot of resources for canvassing and donating, say, for example, whether that be to the DNC, Biden directly, or phone banking, either through the DNC or Progressive Victory, or say the Turnout Pack. Is there a particular organization that you would recommend for people who want to get involved to help turn out that existing voter base?
You know, there really isn't. I think it's for me, it's always go directly to the campaign. Whatever campaign you want to help will help you phone bank or get involved with door knocking or whatever you want to do. But as far as PACs and political organizations, I wouldn't be able to name any specific ones.
All right. Thanks so much for your time.
All right. Thank you so much. Very much appreciate the call. Why don't we go next to, how about Audrey from Central Florida? Audrey from Central Florida, welcome to the program.
How's it going?
It's going well.
All right. I'm trying to think of a question I wanted to ask.
Audrey from Central Florida, thank you very much. Remember, you as we said before, you got to know what you want to ask or don't raise your hand. We can go back to you a little bit later if you come up with a question. Let's go next to Zach from Korea. Zach from Korea, welcome to the program. What can I do for you?
Yeah. Hi, David. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Excuse me. In fact, I'm actually also calling from Central Florida as well, but have spent about 10 years in Korea recently.
Interesting.
And I thought I might bring it up because I thought it was quite interesting that it's not been an issue at all as of late, the topic of Korea. If you remember, actually, when Trump came into office, one of the things he talked about, was how Obama told him this was going to be the big issue for him, right?
Yeah.
Wondering, I mean, I can share some of my insight, but wondering if you had any insight as to why it's not really been an issue this time.
Well, this is so interesting, Zach, because one of the things, there were a bunch of storylines that were really ominous and threatening storylines that we got from Trump in the lead up to the 2020 election. You might recall one of them was, if Biden wins, we'll have a 1929 style stock market depression. Instead, we've had all time high after all time high after all time high. Another narrative was that only thanks to Trump did the situation with Kim Jong-un and North Korea simmer down. And it's because Trump was able to go there and have these conversations with Kim Jong-un and they wrote each other love letters and all this stuff. Only because of that have we not had flare ups with North Korea. And under Biden, it'll be a disaster. And in fact, it's been quite the opposite. It's been one of the calmest periods when it comes to North Korean belligerence that we've had in a long time under President Joe Biden. So I don't necessarily have an explanation for it. A lot of what the cycle, I'm curious to hear from you, but it seems to have a sort of cyclical nature with North Korean leadership, where depending on how bad famine gets, or depending on what's going on globally, there's flare ups and then we give them food aid and then they kind of back off of their belligerence a little bit. But at least, you know, without being able to say the stock market's doing well because of Biden or North Korea has been quiet because of Biden, the fear mongering from Trump that it would all implode certainly hasn't happened. Now, why do you think it's been quiet with North Korea?
It's quite interesting. On a side note, it's kind of interesting here in the U.S. Anytime when I tell someone that I lived in Korea for a long time, how many people will ask, oh, north or south?
As right.
It's even possible. So, I mean, it's understandable to a degree that it's a tiny country on the other side of the world that, you know, a lot of people aren't going to be too familiar with what's going on there. So it makes sense. But honestly, I think there's just a really unfortunate, huge misunderstanding in the media here about what's going on there. Essentially, kind of, people ask me all the time too, like, weren't you afraid living over there? Wasn't it scary being that close to North Korea? But generally, the consensus of people in South Korea is that they just kind of just don't really pay much attention to North Korea. honestly, the Kim Jong-un and the government there is basically just, they just want to be in power and they just want to be left alone. And so long as they're left alone, they're in power and they're happy and there's not really any problem for them. So yeah, when they need something, maybe they might stir up, you know, international attention in some way. But honestly, so long as they're left alone, those that are in power are happy and they don't want to, I mean, why would they cause an issue that might cause them to lose their power, right?
That's interesting. And, you know, friends of mine who either have lived in South Korea or have family in South Korea say very much the same thing, which is really nobody on a day-to-day basis is talking about North Korea nor the Kim family. They're just going about their lives. That matches up very much with what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, people are, you know, sad that the country's not united. Most people in the South would, I mean, they still consider North Korean people as all the same people, right? They want to be united. A lot of people still have an extended family there. So people hope that the situation improves, but I think it's just a situation where there's really just not really much that can be done unless some sort of collapse happens from the inside there. And I think it was basically seen from everyone there at the time that Trump's visit was pretty much not anything but a photo op for Trump.
It was just a photo op.
There,
absolutely.
Yeah, most people there kind of understood it. So,
all right. Well, Zach, thank you so much. Really appreciate the call.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Zach from Korea. Let's go back to Audrey from Central Florida, who I am told now has thought of a question. Remember, folks, only request to speak if you have a question. Audrey, do us proud. Let's go.
All right. I did want to ask about your opinion on the reliability of polling the last few election cycles.
My analysis is that by election day, the polling is basically accurate and does reflect the will of the people. The tricky part is that because the elections are so close, presidential elections, they come down to sometimes under 1 percentage point margin in 5 to 6 states. Even polling that's really good and gets us accurately within a 2 to 3 point margin of error, its predictive value can be limited because, you know, at the end of the day, if the election comes down to Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Georgia and Arizona with 0.5 to 1.5 point margins in those states, the polling can all be accurate within 1.5 to 2.5 points. And it won't actually predict anything because it just comes down to a tiny margin on election day. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so that's my view. I mean, the polling is generally accurate, especially when it comes to the national popular vote. But in terms of really confidently telling us what the Electoral College will end up being, more difficult because elections are coming down to about 500,000 votes in 5 states.
All right. Well, thank you for the answer.
All right. Audrey from Central Florida, thank you for the call. Let's take a very quick break and then we'll go right back to Discord and hear from a few more people. So stand by. All right, let's hear from some more folks on Discord, as we like to do on Fridays. You can find our Discord at davidpakman.com/Discord. Let's go to Gianna from Virginia. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, or is it Gina?
It's Jenna.
Jenna. All right. Well, welcome to the program, Jenna.
Hi. So I have a couple things. I came in a little bit late, so... The other guy from Virginia, I forget his name now, talking about violence. That's actually something that my husband's kind of afraid of, but he's also a veteran, so everything kind of looks like it could lead to a war to him. Mm. But so I actually wanted to talk about something that was from last year's State of the Union, I believe.
Okay.
The when Biden talked about the fees and how they had to publish everything up front so you know what you're paying.
Are you talking about medical or credit cards or which fees?
Basically, like everything, like when you go to book a plane ticket or something, or like a hotel.
Yep.
And then you see the price, but then when you actually pay, it's like $100 more.
Oh, price transparency. So like, in other words, hotels have a practice of showing you a low room rate, but then there's a mandatory resort fee when you check out. And it's like, it's just more money. You should really tell me that up front in the room rate.
Yeah, exactly. So,
Gotcha.
I immediately thought, oh my gosh, that's brilliant because, I've traveled a lot and now that my family has grown, I have four children, we have to think about, we have to really budget well. So, one of the things that I thought of after that was, what if, well, so my question really is, what would you think this would be a good idea? So, I had thought of afterwards, what if we went a little bit further and things like when you're watching commercials and that brand power comes up and it's just like the more expensive brands that are, like you're paying for the name,
Yeah.
they have those special commercials. So what if like products like that, they had to actually put their prices on those commercials? And
What do you
I
mean
mean what?
special brands and special commercials? I don't know what you're talking about.
So like when you're watching regular TV or like not like YouTube, but just like regular TV, they have what's called brand power. And so it comes up and there's like a little purple symbol that says brand power, and then it's just somebody talking about like Swiffer, for example, or I'm trying to think of other brand name things, but it's just like buy these brand name things instead of the store brand
The generic,
things.
okay.
Yeah.
And
So
you want what the price to be on the screen?
yeah, well, like actual price comparison. So like when commercials come up for like things that you buy on the TV, they always publish the price and usually it's like $19.99 or something. But with like name brand things, they're always more money, but they don't tell you why or what the actual price is. They just say, oh, well, I'm just going to use Swiffer as the example, but they say like, oh, Swiffer WetJet picks up, things with this ad that Walmart also has. So
Yeah. Okay, it's an interesting idea. I don't know how you would enforce it. Also, a lot of times brands, like for example, when Mercedes is advertising on TV, that they have 30 different vehicles with five different trims. I don't know how you really like get the price up on the screen necessarily. But Jenna, listen, it's an interesting idea and we do need price transparency. We do need disclosure. I'm all for more information. I just don't know how you enforce or put in place exactly what you're saying, but I'll look into it.
cool, thank you.
All right. Jenna from Virginia, great to hear from you. Why don't we try going next to James from DC? James from DC, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hey, David, big
Hey,
fan.
thank you.
Appreciate what you do.
Thanks.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on RFK, because from where I stand, he seems to almost have evil intentions.
I really can't say he has evil intentions, but what I can tell you are a couple things. Number one, he has no path to victory for two reasons. He doesn't have enough support and he doesn't have the ballot access. Number two, we covered the video of his New York State director, Rita Palma, essentially saying that RFK's campaign shares a goal with Trump's campaign of just denying Biden 270 electoral votes, in which case it would go to the House of Representatives, which they hope will be controlled by Republicans, which then means they will make Trump president. So the fact that deep down it kind of seems as though the real point here is to get Trump elected, especially as there are rumors that RFK might be in Trump's cabinet if that were to happen. For me, none of it is interesting. I'm voting for Biden. I think that's our best choice.
Got you.
I don't know how else to
What do
say it,
you,
you know?
yeah, do you think there's a potential that he's an actor? Like, I know people on the right love to accuse politicians and stuff, but it just seems that way. He seems not genuine.
You know, I know why you're asking that question. I really don't want to. I would be merely speculating, and I have no evidence that this is an act of any kind. So gotcha. I wouldn't be comfortable making that assertion because I don't have any evidence to support that.
All right. Fair enough. Thanks again.
All right. James from D.C., thank you so much for the call. Very much appreciated. Let's go to Dave from Mesquite, Texas. Dave from Texas, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today? What can I do for you? Dave from Mesquite, Texas, second chance to accept my invitation here. And he's gone. Okay. Why don't we go next to, oh, I don't know. How about Jen from Massachusetts / Rhode Island? Jen, welcome back to the program. We've spoken before, right? Jen, please accept my invitation. We can't drop two in a row. That would be really a grinding the show to a halt.
Yes. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. There we go. All right. They updated the app and I didn't quite know how to use it. It's been a while.
All right.
Hi. Ari, long time no speak.
Thank you.
So yeah, I moved from Rhode Island to Mass, but I'm working in Rhode Island, so I'm right on the border.
Got it.
All right. So yeah, I'll get to it. So I am a democratic socialist like you. But
I'm not a democratic socialist. I'm a social democrat. Totally different thing.
Oh, excuse me. All right. All right. Other way around. Sorry. So I am currently in a serious relationship with a very serious Marxist. He's great. He doesn't push it on me or anything, but you know, meeting more of them and everything, I'm curious, what is your whole take on their desire that they think that, oh, in the next 50 years or so, they'll be able to overthrow capitalism and change the entire system. I'm not going to dash his dreams or anything, but part of me thinks that it's kind of a utopia that's not going to be able to happen. And, you know, I met them. They're all like, they're very nice people. I went to an entire convention. They're well educated. They're very passionate.
Yep.
But I don't quite know what to make of their world. And I was just wondering, what is your whole opinion on, you know, the big like serious Marxist communist movement that's happening?
Well, as a non-Marxist and non-communist, obviously I'm not in favor of it. Now, the predictive question of will there be the downfall of capitalism and the rebuilding of a Marxist or Leninist communist state in the model of maybe the Soviet Union or whatever example? Does the guy you're dating, does he say it would be great for it to be like X, Y, or Z country? Or what is his ideal?
Their ideal is basically after the Russian Revolution, basically. Okay. The Lenin Marxist kind of thing of it, that, oh, we won't need cars anymore and we won't need this anymore.
Yeah.
And yes, evidently like Star Trek isn't even communist enough for them. Star Trek is Stalinist.
Well, listen,
that, oh, you know,
predictions are worth what you pay for them. And you're paying zero for this one. I'm very skeptical that in the next 50 years, that's going to happen. In the next 150, could it happen? Sure. It wouldn't be something I would push for because I think that markets directing resources in a large number of industries is fine. I don't want the government owning or controlling entire industries and businesses. Like, it's just they're not my values. And I have a video why I'm not a socialist, which also deals with communism and Marxism. And you can check that out. As far as the prediction, I mean, listen, we just have to wait and see. I doubt that the United States will have collapsed and been rebuilt in the mode of the post-Russian Revolution Leninist Marxist model, but it's not impossible. But we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, I just see it as like, how are you going to overthrow, you know, this current system when it is so ingrained and, you know, with the government having so much power and everything? So
well,
I see
sometimes they say it's not that we're going to overthrow it. It's that it's going to collapse in on itself. So it depends on what their view is. Sometimes they believe it's so unsustainable, it'll just collapse and then they'll be able to rebuild their communist paradise. But I'd be shocked if either happened in 50 years. But, you know, when Trump says we will never be a communist country, never is a very long time. What about 150 years? What about 500? What about 1,000? I don't know. Maybe we will.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, hey, real quick. I actually left. I was able to travel out the country for the first time last August and happened to be in Spain at the same time as you.
Oh, is that right? But, where in Spain did you go?
Sevilla.
And how'd you like it?
Oh, God, I loved it. We went to Marseille right before that, but I rathered Spain a little bit more, even though it was like 106 degrees.
Yeah, when I was in Madrid in August, it was like 97 every day. It was crazy.
I was in their train station. I think that was the one with the big jungle inside of it.
I didn't go to the train station, but I'll take your word for that. Yeah. But just so hot, but beautiful country, high quality of life.
Yes, and those green conures everywhere that evidently the locals hate.
Is that right?
They call them a plague.
All right. Well, Jen, great to hear from you. Appreciate it. Thank you. Take care. Why don't we go next to Jay from Detroit? Jay from Detroit, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today? Jay, welcome. Please, your turn to speak.
Hey, David, how are you?
Doing well.
So listen, I wanted to ask you about something I've had on my mind for a while now.
Okay.
I've been concerned for a while that Russia and Saudi Arabia, who may have a political interest in seeing Trump victorious over Biden, may reduce oil production or exports to otherwise inflate oil prices in the U.S. Mm-hmm. With the strategic intention of increasing the price of gasoline right before the presidential election. As of early March, both countries have already extended production cuts through the end of the second quarter. And the price of gasoline in my area has risen about 60 cents over the last few months, maybe since the beginning of the year.
Mm.
How much of a problem is this in your opinion?
You know, I think that the I haven't looked at what you're telling me, but I accept that you're right on the facts. My instinct is that it is going to have let's say they're trying to do exactly what you're saying for exactly the reasons that you're saying. I think the effect on gas prices will be relatively limited, and the impact of gas prices alone, if inflation is otherwise stable, is going to be limited. And if inflation is otherwise stable, it's not going to change the bigger picture that if the economy looks more or less like it looks today, it's a pretty good economy, and presidents tend to get reelected when the economy is pretty good. So it's sort of like, even granting everything you're saying, which I haven't looked into, I don't think that it alone is what the election is going to hinge on. That's my instinct.
I hope you're right. For the record, Axios had a great article in early March that kind of delved into this a little bit. I guess the second part of my question would be also, is there room on the show for a deep dive into foreign economic influences like this one?
There is absolutely room. I mean, it's almost too big of a topic to make into one segment, but let me look into it and then we'll see what we can do.
Great. Thanks for your time. It was good speaking with you.
All right. Jay from Detroit. Great to hear from you. And by the way, Jay, also a website member, which I very, very much appreciate. Let's go to Chris from Kansas City. Chris from Kansas City, what's on your mind today? What's going on? Chris from Kansas City, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Sorry about that. I didn't accept the call. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing all right. Just a couple questions. One's regarding voting in general, and the other is about polling. I'll start with the polling one first. I voted for Biden in 2020. Uh-huh. And since then, you know, everything that Trump's done and everything that has sort of transpired since that election kind of gives me pause when I see the polling numbers. I have a hard time sort of quantifying why the polling numbers for Trump are so high. And it makes me feel like something's wrong with the polling, but it also makes me think that maybe I'm misunderstanding how polling is done. And maybe it's just me trying to rectify the strange, you know, high numbers that Trump gets. So I was hoping maybe you could clarify maybe how polling is done and why his numbers are so high.
So how polling is done, you can just read the methodology at the bottom of every poll. Every poll is done a little bit differently. So I would direct you there as far as that goes. In terms of why Trump's numbers are so high, it depends who you want to listen to. You know, folks like Rachel Bitticoffer are saying the intentions of voters come November just aren't reflected yet, because only 15% or so of the country is actually paying attention to the election at this point in time. I think that number is probably a little bit low, but I do think that there are lots of folks sort of toying with the idea of voting third party who ultimately aren't going to. But if we really zoom out, part of the reason Trump's numbers are so high is there is a large share of Americans who are not in. This is on both sides now. Who aren't influenced by what is actually happening on the ground. They have just decided which team they are supporting, and it's basically that is it. And so it's a it's an unfortunate reality. Chris, it's so loud where you are that I'm going to let you go just because it's not the best. But unfortunately, a large portion of the electorate does not care what the facts on the ground are. They are either voting Trump or voting Biden. It exists on both sides. I would argue that it is more logical to vote for Biden, based on what's actually taken place. That's my personal view. And of course, it's biased. But that's where I would put it. Let's go to a break. Sorry I didn't get to everyone, but we will take calls again. All right, it's time for Friday feedback. You can email info@davidpakman.com if you have a message for me, a question, a comment, something you'd like addressed on Friday. We will also take Facebook messages, Twitter replies, YouTube comments. You never know what is going to be featured on Friday feedback. Let's start with our favorite Facebooker. It is Max Shaz, who continues to brutally assault me and says, David, you disrespected President Trump and mocked him. We the people are tired of this. You owe him and the American people an apology. We have determined that these messages from Max are not satirical. We've researched Max a little bit, and he is serious when he says this stuff. What I would say to Trump. So Max wants me to apologize to Trump. I would say to Trump, he is the one who owes the American people an apology after making a mockery of the presidency and the Oval Office and our democratic institutions. It is he and those who voted for him, maybe including Max, who really need to be out there and apologizing. Give me a break, Max. Very, very disconnected from reality, that's for sure. A lot of comments about my new children's book, Think Like a Voter, which I have right here. Logan says, are 8-year-olds voting now? Nice detail on the girl's red hat front with a big yellow star surrounded by 4 smaller stars. So first of all, there's no yellow stars. They're white. I don't know what is special about that detail. What I will tell you is that, of course, the book isn't for kids because 8-year-olds vote. The book is for kids because too many 8-year-olds, by the time they're 18, don't even have any idea why it's so important to vote and to engage the political process. So yes, I am targeting kids who aren't being taught by their parents or educators about how we choose our leaders, why it's so important, how to have a say and a stake in the democratic process. It's not because 8-year-olds are voting. It's because someday 8-year-olds will vote, but not if we wait until they're 20 before we tell them about voting. So that's the reason why. Now, a lot of other messages about the book. Maddie wrote in and said, think like a voter, from the guy who wanted to remove a political candidate off a ballot for a crime he was not found guilty of, with charges brought by people who don't have the authority to enforce the amendment. So I think what Maddie is referring to are the cases seeking to remove Trump from ballots for having engaged in insurrection. Now, you could say I wanted to remove Trump. But more accurate would be to say what I actually said, which is Trump certainly meets the definition of having incited an insurrection. But I would rather just beat him by voting. If you objectively say to me, did he do the thing that he's accused of? He did. It's not about crime. You're not required to be found guilty of a crime to be removed from the ballot for violating the 14th Amendment. So Maddie doesn't understand the law. Maddie doesn't understand what I said. And Maddie doesn't understand my opinion. But I will be clear. My preference would be to just beat Trump. I said all along, we're not going to beat Trump by getting him off the ballot. We're going to beat Trump by defeating him at the ballot box. And that continues to be my view. Family Love wrote in about the books and said, "Thank you, David, for your wonderful books introducing children to the processes of critical thinking. I'm a grandmother with my own collection of some wonderful children's books. I'm proud to say your first two books are already part of my collection, and I can't wait to buy this new one. Please keep up your wonderful work, David." Well, thank you so much. And of course, you can get the books at davidpakman.com/book. Brian wrote in on TikTok and says, "Can you explain why student debt forgiveness is a good thing for the nation? Free education is one thing, but this is another." Yeah, it's a totally fair question. The economic multiplier of student loan debt forgiveness is quite high. I've talked about this before. I don't want to bore people because this has been coming up so much. But just as a reminder, tax cuts for the rich, the money overwhelmingly just goes into a bank account. Low economic multiplier doesn't do that much for the economy. On the other hand, food stamps have a high economic multiplier. Food stamps go to people who really need them. Those folks are going to spend that money. They go into their local store, supports jobs at the supermarket, supports the jobs of the suppliers to the supermarket, high economic multiplier. Forgiving student loan debt, in particular for folks who are struggling to make their student loan payments, has a very high economic multiplier because you're shifting that dollar amount from going to banks as interest to being kept by people who need the money and are almost certainly going to spend it in their local communities. They'll spend it at local businesses. They'll spend it at local restaurants. And so it's good for the country to take a bunch of money that was going to pay interest at banks and instead say, keep it injected into your local economy. It's good for the economy. Now, there's another aspect to this, which is that there's this cycle, and we've talked about it before many times, where the cost of college continues to increase in part, because colleges can get away with it because student loan money is so easy to access. And we need to do something to push down the cost of college. Now, paying off student loan debt is not necessarily going to achieve that. But if we can do that in addition to maybe saying it's not going to be quite so easy to get unlimited student loan money for any degree, although there's controversial, there's two sides to this, maybe it can be the start of a more serious conversation about how to push down the cost of higher education. Not a guarantee, but there are a lot of ways in which student loan debt relief is good for the country. Arletha Pappas says, "We're all just exhausted from Donald's chaos. Even those who pretend not to want Biden have to appreciate his calming presence." You know, they don't. Arletha, there are lots of folks who don't see Biden as calming. They see him as incompetent or demented or not really in charge. Or, you know, you can really see whatever you want when you're committed to seeing whatever you want. I happen to agree that there couldn't be a starker contrast between the sober way in which Biden has executed the office of the presidency with absolutely no scandals. There's no scandals. Oh, but what about the criminal bribery? Yeah, there's no evidence of that. Oh, but what about the impeachable offenses? They've still found none. There is a major difference, black and white, between Biden and Trump. But there are people who see Trump as a pseudo deity, and they would vote for him 3-4. They would make him president for life if it were up to them. So it's up to us to make sure that the folks that don't want to see it aren't in the majority. And the way we do that is by voting in November. Fun Comparison asks on the subreddit, "Who's Trump's favorite dictator and which one does he want to be like the most? I think it's a tie between Hitler and Kim Jong-un. What do you guys think?" No, you know, Trump is enamored with dictators and authoritarian strongmen. I think Trump would love to be a blend of Xi and Putin. He seems most impressed by Xi and Putin for different reasons. With Putin, he seems impressed at the way everyone really acts impressed with Putin because they're scared. And Trump really seems to be fascinated by that, riveted by it, you could even say. So I think Putin's high on Trump's list. And then with Xi, he loves how Xi executes this brutal law enforcement paradigm, where he talks about quick trials and the death penalty for drug dealers, which Trump seemingly would love to do. So I know about the Hitler speeches on Trump's nightstand, according to one of Trump's ex-wives. I know about the love letters with Kim Jong-un, but I don't think he's as impressed with Kim Jong-un. He's impressed with Kim Jong-un as look at what this young guy has done. But he genuinely seems just smitten with Putin and Chinese President Xi. If you disagree with me, let me know. And lastly, here's a viewer who is reacting to my horror about Trump by saying, and Biden doesn't horrify you? Please, God forbid he gets us in another conflict and bows down to those bullies pushing us around. We need strong leadership. The world's watching and Biden's like the girl next door, sweet but no backbone. Again, I don't know what conflict Biden, quote, got us into. And I don't know which leaders Biden is, quote, bowing down to. In fact, even with the allegation that he's bowing down to Netanyahu, the last week of news certainly doesn't suggest that that's the case. Getting on the phone and saying you've got to do a ceasefire, you've got to let Gaza aid through, pushing for more Gaza aid. And now the IDF says the invasion has been suspended. I don't see Biden being pushed around by anybody. And if he were, I would certainly tell you. So another confused Trump supporter. But remember, you can be confused and vote. You can have a completely backwards sort of moral framework and vote. And so the only way we make sure that these folks don't end up putting their guy in power is we have to make sure that we vote. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. You can sign up at joinpacman.com and get instant access. And remember that all of the children's books, including the newest one, Think Like a Voter, makes a great election year gift for the child in your life or in someone else's life. The books are all available at davidpacman.com/book. We will see you on the bonus show and be back. Say what you want about the validity and importance of polls in April of an election year. The tone and the feel and the dynamics of this presidential race are changing. And we start with new polling in which things are looking pretty damn good for President Joe Biden. Nothing is a guarantee. More than likely, this is an election that will come down to about 500,000 votes in 5 states. But if you have an option between it'll be close and the polls look bad for Biden, or it'll be close and the polls look pretty good for Biden, if your goal is to prevent the potential downfall of democracy with 4 years of dangerous authoritarianism, you choose, if you're a logical person, as I try to be, you choose the scenario in which the polls look better. And indeed, Joe Biden is now beating Donald Trump in a majority of polls. I'll be honest, it's a very slim majority, right? It's like 50% plus one polls. But also, the betting markets have shifted for the first time towards Joe Biden in months. And individually, none of it means anything. There are people who will write to me and say, David, those stupid prediction markets mean nothing. It's kids in their mom's basements playing on websites. All right, well, we can ignore the betting markets. Oh, and David, the polling also means nothing. Well, there is a momentum shift in the polling from a small lead by Trump to a small lead by Biden. By itself, maybe it doesn't tell us everything we need to know, but it all still together is a picture that rejects the notion that Biden can't win. That's the important takeaway. So many have fallen into this doom and gloom. Biden simply cannot win. And there is no evidence whatsoever that Biden cannot win. He might not win. Right. That's true. But he certainly can win. So Newsweek reports Joe Biden is now beating Donald Trump in the majority of recent polls 7 months before the election. Analysis has turned to who will come out on top. Polls have been evenly split, with commentators suggesting the race is too close to call. And it is too close to call. I mean, any election that will come down to 500,000 votes in 5 states and possibly a 1 or 1.5 point margin separating the candidates in those critical states, it is too close to call but we have data we can look at. And as the article points out, polls appear to be moving in Joe Biden's favor. And that is something we like to see. So we look at a bunch of different polls here. One of the things is we really should divide the polls into the higher quality versus the lower quality polls. Some of those higher quality polls include The Economist, which has it as Trump plus one, but they previously had Trump further ahead. The Ipsos Reuters poll has Biden ahead among adults by one and among registered voters by four. The Morning Consult poll has Trump plus one, but it previously had Trump leading by more. The tip.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
In the face of the Iranian threat, we will build a regional coalition and exact the price from Iran in the fashion and timing that is right for us. And most importantly, faced with the desire of our enemies to harm us, we will continue to unite and become stronger.
The Middle East braces for Israel to retaliate amidst calls for restraint after Iran fired over 300 drones and missiles at Israel in response to Israel's attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria. We'll go to Tehran, Tel Aviv, and Washington, D.C. Then Donald Trump makes history today in a New York courtroom as the first former president to stand trial for criminal charges.
On Monday in New York City, I will be forced to sit fully gagged. I'm not allowed to talk. Can you believe it? They want to take away my constitutional right to talk. I have a crooked judge.
Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg may be the only prosecutor in four pending criminal cases to try Trump on criminal charges before Election Day. Jury selection begins today. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for maximum restraint after Iran launched 300 drones and missiles at Israel in retaliation for Israel's recent bombing of the Iranian consulate in Damascus. The Iranian attack caused little damage after Israel intercepted nearly all of the drones and missiles with help from the United States, Britain, France, and Jordan. One 7-year-old Bedouin girl in Israel was seriously injured in the attack after she was hit by shrapnel. While Iran and Israel have been engaged in a shadow war for years, this marked the first time Iran has directly targeted Israel from Iranian soil. The UN Secretary General spoke Sunday at an emergency UN Security Council meeting.
The Middle East is on the brink. The people of the region are confronting a real danger of a devastating full-scale conflict. Now is the time to defuse and de-escalate. Now is the time for maximum restraint.
Israeli War Cabinet member Benny Gantz has vowed Israel will retaliate against Iran.
In the face of the Iranian threat, we will build a regional coalition and exact the price from Iran in the fashion and timing that is right for us.
President Biden has reiterated his ironclad support for Israel, but he reportedly told Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the United States will not participate in any retaliatory strikes against Iran. At the United Nations Sunday, Iran's UN ambassador, Saeed Erivani, defended the missile and drone attack on Israel, saying it was done in self-defense.
These countries, especially the United States, have shielded Israel from any responsibility for the Gaza massacre, while they have denied Iran inherent right to self-defense against the Israeli armed attack on our diplomatic premises. At the same time, they shamefully justified the Israeli massacre and genocide against the defenseless Palestinian people under the pretext of self-defense.
We'll go to Tehran, Washington, D.C., and Tel Aviv after headlines. Israel's continuing its assault on Gaza, where the official death toll has reached 33,800. On Sunday, Israeli forces opened fire on displaced Palestinians who are attempting to return to their homes in northern Gaza. Israel also bombed the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza, killing at least five people and injuring dozens. In the occupied West Bank, armed settlers attacked the Palestinian village